Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, with a variety of meats for grilling, roasting, and meal prepping. Harmon's, your food, our passion.
Back in June, the Trump administration announced it wanted to repeal the so-called roadless rule. This is a policy from 2001 that restricts road building and logging in tens of millions of acres of undeveloped national forest. The administration said getting rid of the rule will give local officials more flexibility to manage wildfires and support timber-based economies. But critics say it could lead to excessive logging, and it could degrade wildlife habitat and watersheds. One of our guests on the show today told us this story fits into an historical pattern. A cycle where the Forest Service's mission shifts depending on the political climate. Chris Wood is the president of Trout Unlimited. It's a conservation group opposed to getting rid of the roadless rule. And Wood used to work for the Forest Service. And he says the agency's mandate has never been static. Over time, it's been pulled between these competing values, conservation versus exploitation, ecological science versus economic pressure. So he says this isn't the first time forest policy has sparked this national debate. In fact, he told us this story from more than 100 years ago during the administration of Theodore Roosevelt. Roosevelt made conservation a defining feature of his presidency. And with the help of Gifford Pinchot, his chief forester, the president spent his administration increasing the number of protected acres of forest land, which infuriated conservative lawmakers, especially those in the West. So in response, they passed a law to cut off Roosevelt's power to create any new forest reserves in six Western states. But in that law, Wood says there was a loophole. It wouldn't take effect until March 4th, 1907.
The day before that law took effect, midnight, Gifford Pinchot walked across the mall to the White House, and he and Theodore Roosevelt sat on the floor of a room in the White House, and they marked off 13 million acres. They called them the Midnight Reserves that they created as national forest. And until 1945, the Forest Service's mandate was to basically maintain these national forests. There was timber cutting, but it was very judicious and measured. And then after the war, when all of these servicemen came home and there was a big demand for wood products because they wanted homes to live in fairly, the Forest Service responded to that. And that's why from 1960 to 89, 1990, they harvested between 9 to 12 billion board feet a year. And then we had the growth of this environmental awakening in America. Silent Spring with Rachel Carson, and the passage of the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, all these laws in the early 70s. And I think probably by around 1980, the Forest Service found itself out of step with where America was going. And that continued, I would argue, until a judge in the Pacific Northwest said that the agency had been demonstrating a reckless disregard for the law. And shut down timber harvesting in the old growth forests of Oregon, Washington, and parts of California. That's the origin, that's the history of the Forest Service up to the roadless rule. Then they went through this awkward period from 1990 to 1997, where it was kind of like, well, what is our role? And we had a whole natural resource agenda we created for the agency that involved better management of roads, emphasizing recreation. And so that's what we tried to do with our natural resource agenda. The roadless rule was a huge part of that. And happily, I would say the last 24 years, the last quarter century of the Forest Service, they have gone back to their roots and they have supplied a steady stream of timber. It's not back up to 9 to 12 billion board feet because that's unsustainable. But their emphasis on watershed restoration is best in class. National forests are the lungs of the nation, and they're also the arteries of the nation because so much drinking water comes from national forests. And so they've done a tremendous job to basically help to recover the ecological health of our national forests. And in the context of doing that, provide a supply of timber and forage and oil and gas and, you know, other multiple use benefits. And that, I think, is being lost in this conversation, that it's as though these roadless areas are being put up there as other quasi-wilderness. They're not. You know, in the state of Utah, almost 85% of the roadless areas are open for grazing. 30% of the motorized trails in the state are in roadless areas. So my hope is that cooler heads will prevail and we won't end up throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the attempt to get rid of the roadless rule. We spoke recently with the reporter Kevin Lind. He's a staff writer with the Deseret News. And Lind says the effort to repeal this rule is moving ahead at a pace that's quite different from when it was created nearly 25 years ago.
There were hundreds of public meetings. I reported out 400. Other places have reported out 600 meetings. At least 20,000 people participated in these public hearings. And the public comment period was quite large as well. You received 1.6 million public comments, and they were overwhelmingly in support of the roadless rule. The final environmental impact statement that was done about the roadless rule, their listed reasons were, you know, they wanted to protect clean water. They wanted to ensure that there was biological diversity, that recreational opportunities were still dispersed and available, and people didn't have to kind of encounter development in our country's wild spaces. They were protective of habitats and forest health. And it was kind of this, you know, kind of like seemingly very well-intentioned conservation effort at a national scale, which was kind of a little kumbaya-ish in face of so many of the other multiple uses that these Forest Service lands are used for, because there's a tremendous amount of logging that happens on them. There's a tremendous amount of natural resource extraction that also happens on them, just like BLM land and otherwise. And so then it kind of became this kind of this great adversarial instance of conservation and resource extraction. And it went back and forth, you know, and initially Idaho and Wyoming sued, but eventually those legal battles got all the way to the Supreme Court in the mid-2010s, deciding to no longer hear any cases about it. But, you know, it's been a long time since it's been challenged. And it's been a long time since anyone's kind of seriously considered repealing it or considering it otherwise.
So after it went through this really extensive environmental analysis, public comment process, it went through all of these legal channels and challenges. So it finally seems stable or somewhat settled by around 2013 or so. It just sort of sits there. And then what happens? I guess the answer is the Trump administration happens. Is that right?
Yeah, that's the answer. And I don't know if this fell under Trump 1.0's kind of ire. I don't know if this was something that he was considering in his first term. But, you know, in his second term, he signed a number of executive orders that more or less address this directly. There was one specifically about timber logging. There was another about unleashing American energy. There was another about deregulation. So it kind of like specifically focused on U.S. Forest Service lands in a couple of instances. And so, yeah, come this past January and then this past June, the Trump administration decided that they would like to repeal the roadless rule.
One of the questions is why? And who are the people who are talking to him? And rather than just saying who it is that is advocating for something like this, talk a little bit about the interests here, because the president has discussed the idea of wanting to use public land and natural resources as a kind of engine of economic growth. Mm-hmm. And you're hearing from, I mean, timber interests. That's the thing that sort of comes up as a question of whether or not that what they're doing here by repealing this roadless rule is just making it, you know, timber more accessible. So can you talk a little bit about this, the sort of interests that are playing out in the way the president is making these decisions?
I think what they're saying outright is that the most important interests are the rural communities that live adjacent to or within some of these roadless areas. So when they're kind of are speaking about it, it's about the, you know, the small town that could either benefit from more industry in the area, reducing the threat of wildfire from these roadless areas. You know, in terms of like who are their first interests, that's who they would say outright. And that's kind of what appears in the federal notice. But in terms of, you know, what would be the purpose for opening up? This is speculative, but yeah, like logging interests would be the kind of the first folks who might benefit from being able to open up these spaces or from there being increased access to these large forests. You know, the Tongass Forest in Alaska is almost 10 million acres of land that has been protected in massive timber area, like forests. And so there's going to suddenly be access to a lot more timber. The bill does not state in any way, shape, or form that logging will be increased, that new projects will be signed on, so on and so forth. What it does, though, is it means that local land managers, because all of these forests have their own employees who are dedicated to those specific forests and their own relationships with their local, municipal, city and state governments, and they'll be able to make the best possible decisions for their specific location. Now, that doesn't mean to say that all of the areas that are currently roadless will suddenly become roaded. That was a point that Tom Schultz made very clearly. But it allows those local land managers to make specific decisions based on whatever it is that they see as the best possible use slash need for the forest that they're managing. But now they can consider things that they were not allowed to consider in the past simply by being able to build roads into those locations. Because a logging company is not going to start logging an area or a roadless area, an area that doesn't have a means of getting in or out. An energy company is not going to start mining or extracting resources if they don't have means of access.
It seems like one of the arguments, or the maybe even the principal argument that the administration is making, is not just about the fact that local timber companies should have an easier way of getting to you know, trees, but it's that this is about controlling wildfires. That seems like the argument that they're most leaning into. Would you talk about the way they're talking about roads being necessary to fight wildfire?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're right, by the way. It has been the argument that's foregrounded. There's the deregulation argument, and then the wildfire one is the second one. Maybe if not the first, depending on who you're speaking with. Hmm. Chief Schultz likened it. He used a military analogy, and he said, if you're trying to fight a war and you only have an air force, you're not going to be able to win. He's like, you still need ground troops, and you still need access for people to not only reach the areas from the sky, but also reach the areas from the ground. And so if you're trying to fight a wildfire, you need to be able to have access to the wildfire. And so the roads provide the access for firefighters to get into areas that might be burning. The question of whether or not the wildfires are a bad thing or a good thing is hard. And it's hard because wildfire is extremely dangerous and has the potential to cost massive amounts of money and be really threatening to folks' life and livelihoods. Mm-hmm. But at the same breath, it is a kind of natural and necessary element of like a lot of these larger ecosystems, especially in the Intermountain West and in Alaska and all the boreal forest, really kind of north. But building roads into the areas would essentially just allow them greater access to fight wildfires.
Where are you going to get the money to build these roads that you want to build? I mean, the argument is that the federal government doesn't have the money to build these roads in the first place, and that they haven't even been able to maintain the roads they have. Are you hearing that argument?
Yeah, I mean, that comes up quite often. A lot of people have mentioned, or a lot of conservationists or activists have expressed concern over the fact that there's billions of dollars in backlog maintenance. And so the idea of not addressing the roads that are in bad shape currently and building new ones is not the best way to kind of move forward through, you know, construction projects. And, you know, the U.S. Forest Chief Schultz essentially said, you know, to think that we have every road right now that we need, he thinks that is a bad argument. He thinks that's not true and not realistic. And his point is that no matter what, will always have to be maintaining roads. There's going to be no like point where all of the roads are maintained perfectly, so on and so forth. The larger point is, where is that money going to come from?
Yeah.
And I don't really know the answer. There's the potential for private interests to be able to pay for their own roads, presumably. There's also the, if the government wants something bad enough, certain things can be financed, you know. But I think that argument is being glossed over in the face of, well, we still need roads, that kind of shoulder shrug approach.
One thing that may be surprising to some is that even though there's this executive order, and you would think that the roadless rule would just be summarily repealed, they'll just do it. But the fact is, there's actually going to be a public comment period. There's going to be an environmental rule. And I guess the question is why? If the executive branch figures it has the power to just repeal the rule, why not just do it? And I guess the answer is they can't just do it. There has to be some kind of process here.
That's correct. They have to follow the Administrative Procedure Act, which kind of applies to executive agencies, where they have to take into consideration more than just kind of the prevailing winds of administration. And so there's a public comment period that they have to follow, and then they have to do a full analysis, kind of an environmental impact review, and then they'll represent kind of what their policy has determined, take another kind of round of public comment, and then they'll issue the rule.
How do you compare, Kevin, the process that Chief Schultz is promising to the process that played out in 2001, where, as you mentioned, there was 3 years of this analysis. There were 400 or 600, you know, public meetings. There was 1.6 million submissions received during that process. 20,000 people showed up at these meetings. I mean, how is the process now that they have in mind that they have to follow? How is that going to differ, do you think, from the process that happened in the first place?
Yeah, well, Chief Schultz would say that this is an expeditious review and that the Trump administration likes to move fast in general.
Yeah.
He wants to get out of the way, so to speak, of this rule being able to get repealed. But yeah, they're very different processes. One transpired over several years. This one will, by the end of next year, so kind of a little over a year from now, the Trump administration said in their, you know, their notice published in the Federal Register that they plan to have a rule in place by the end of 2026. It's very, very different. Far fewer people will be able to make a comment, and the period of review will be very different.
It's also, you're going to have to rely on the objective analysis of the administration. Because the question is whether the public comment period or this environmental review, however, you know, curtailed and abbreviated, is going to change the agriculture secretary's mind about the roadless rule. Because as you point out in your piece, she's already been clear about what she thinks about the rule. Mm-hmm. Will any of this change her mind?
I mean, I asked that of Chief Schultz directly, and he said that she's going to review everything and they're going to do a very thorough analysis. And then once all of the information is kind of processed and laid out, the secretary will have the final decision to make.
Kevin, what do you think would happen if this roadless rule goes away?
In this short term, you know, kind of like in the, you know, the months and years that follow.
Yeah.
What happens is, you know, it goes back to land managers who then get to open up these areas for more multiple use purposes. And that'll depend on each particular land use plan in each particular region. You know, they're likely, if the roadless rule is repealed in time, depending on how the legal process shakes out, how much litigation comes of the repeal, how successful that litigation is, permits will be applied for, and, you know, there'll kind of be a spread of the building of roads, I guess, in some of these forests. But how much? Who knows? And Tom Schultz specifically used this number of 25 million acres. He said that probably would stay pristine. Maybe it was just speculative, but not all of, you know, this 44.7 million acres will immediately get used for logging. But there is the potential for 30% of the Forest Service lands to suddenly be considered available for logging and timber and roads to be built and any number of other kind of developmental uses.
Kevin Lind, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kevin Lind. He's a staff writer on the ideas and culture team at the Deseret News. We have links to his reporting on our website, radiowest.org. The first public comment period on the repeal of the roadless rule closed a few weeks ago. The Agriculture Department is reviewing those comments. They should have a draft proposal ready by March of next year. Then there will be another round of public comments. A final decision isn't expected until late next year. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, with a variety of meats for grilling, roasting, and meal prepping. Harmon's, your food, our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about this proposal from the Trump administration to roll back a policy called the roadless rule. It's been in place for nearly 25 years, and it's survived five different presidential administrations. Getting rid of the rule could open up tens of millions of acres of undeveloped national forests to logging and road building. Recently, we talked to Reg Johnson about the rule. Johnson is the director of Utah's Public Lands Policy Coordinating Office. It's a state agency that advises the governor on public land issues. And Johnson has been critical of the roadless rule. He says it actually limits efforts to keep forest ecosystems healthy.
We saw from the very get-go with the restrictions that they were putting into the rule that it was going to be very problematic when it comes to active management of our forests. And why is that important? You know, for 115 years now, since the fires of 1910, we've been putting out pretty much every single fire, which was a good thing. If you look at what happened in the fires of 1910, it was catastrophic, lost a lot of communities. But we live in a fire-dependent ecosystem, and when you start putting out every single fire, then you have a lot of growth, which is not necessarily a bad thing until you restrict the ability to deal with that growth.
Tell me a little bit more what you mean by active management. It seems like it's something that Tom Schultz, he's the, of course, the chief of the Forest Service, said recently. He said leaving things alone doesn't mean that things will be managed. You've talked about we need to actively manage our national forests. Help me understand what you mean by actively manage, as opposed to what you think is in place now, which is some sort of passive system, I suppose.
Yeah. Active management, you know, opposition groups that are opposed to logging are going to come out and say, you know, active management is just a code word for doing logging projects, and couldn't be further from the truth. From the state of Utah's perspective and what we do with active management, there are times when we're not even taking logs off the forest for milling. Sometimes it's prescribed fires and mastication, which is where actually grinding the tree up, then reseeding in areas, working in the sagebrush biome and the juniper pinyon biome, doing a lot of different prescriptions. And the reason that's so important is because that's what creates the best wildlife habitat. If you don't have active management, what you often end up with is decadent growth. And whether that's decadent sagebrush, overgrown juniper pinyon, areas where it starts limiting wildlife habitat and other ecosystem services, watershed, water quality, water quantity, those kind of things can all be affected. It's a struggle because nature is very dynamic. And if you don't actively manage those areas, it's like not actively managing your yard or your garden. Pretty soon the yard becomes weed infested, or the garden becomes weed infested. And then the plants that are more healthy for the ecosystem can't thrive like they should.
Let me ask you, I think some may be saying, well, wait a minute. Are you saying that for it to be a healthy process, there has to be human intervention in it? Because some would say, well, it's a natural process would just leave it alone, and it's going to have a natural sort of cycle to it.
So explain. Great question.
Yeah,
and I will say this: if we go back to pre-pioneer settlement, even the Native Americans were actively managing these areas.
Yeah.
You can go back and see where they were doing garden spots, and they were burning areas, and they were creating these areas where they would have better forage for wildlife. Now,
I go back to my original answer, which talked about 110 years of fire suppression. Mm-hmm. So what most people don't get is that was the biggest change of any change that we've ever made on the landscape in the Western U.S. We live in a fire-dependent ecosystem.
Yeah.
Then for those that are opposed to redoing the wilderness area, or excuse me, the roadless areas, they think that we can just let this area go. Well, can we just let an area go above our population centers where that's the water source for us, right? No, we can't. And whether that's rural Utah or the Wasatch Front, you can't just let nature take its course anymore. One, we have way too much fuel loads, historically high fuel loads on these areas. So if a fire were to start in these areas, it burns hotter, burns faster, makes it more difficult to control. What does that do to our air quality? So it's better to actively manage, do these thinning projects so that we can control intensity of the fire. We can control how much pollution is in the air. There will be limited amounts of sediment that gets into streams when we do active management, but we can control that.
You have talked about being excited with what you call a new direction for the Department of Agriculture. Is this what you mean by that new direction? And compare that to what you see as the old direction.
Yeah. We are excited to have partners that are willing to look at common sense solutions to natural resource problems. And unfortunately, some administrations in D.C., they think the museum management of just lock it up and throw away the key and don't do any management is the way to go. And from personal experience working on these landscapes and from all the lessons learned by rural communities, that is not generally the best way to manage these resources.
I wanted to ask you about the local component. The Forest Service, Tom Schultz, for example, he said the federal government has, in its earlier iteration, was not allowing for what he described as local conditions or local input. Is that where you are? There has to be a sort of a local input, a local control. Is that one of your arguments as well?
Absolutely. One of the problems with the roadless rule, while it did allow for some harvesting of woody material, it was limited to small diameter trees. Well, if you're in a lodgepole pine forest, that's okay. But if you get into, you know, a larger diameter trees, then in, say, southern Utah, you couldn't harvest anything to make a difference. Mm. But we need the ability to manage in that area. And I think a good example of that is the beetle kill issue that we have in the state of Utah. If you've ever been up on the Skyline Drive or some of the mountains in southern Utah, or even in Uintas.
On that point, when you drive up Wolf Creek Pass, for example, now this was before the fire, let me just sort of put that, but you would see a lot of beetle kill. And you had local timber companies in Duchesne County who wanted access to that.
Yes.
Is that what you're talking about?
Yes. So it's a win-win, right? So you're allowing a local timber company to go in there, have access to a material that they can put to a beneficial use. And that's also a benefit to the ecosystem. By removing that old dead timber, then you have new growth that comes up, which then ironically sucks up more carbon versus a wildfire, which releases a lot of carbon and a lot of other air pollutants that we struggle with for air quality concerns. I think, you know, some of the highest air quality problems we've had in the state of Utah resulted from wildfires.
Yeah.
So that's that dynamic that we're trying to deal with, and why we would really prefer rules that weren't so set in stone and easily litigated and able to stop good projects from going forward.
Do you, Mr. Johnson, do you need to kill the roadless rule? Can't you just fix it?
I wish it were fixable, but I'm not sure it is. And I think that's a good point, though, because everybody says, you know, you're killing the roadless rule, like it's going to suddenly open up all these areas that, you know, were under the roadless rule and you're going to be driving through them and all this. that's not how it works. If they get rid of the roadless rule and you want to do a forest project out there, then you have to go through that process. So that's another public comment period that you go through. That you want to put a road in, you have to go through the travel management planning process, which is another public process. So just because you get rid of the roadless rule doesn't mean that suddenly all these areas are open for use and all the old roads are there. It's another thing, you know, the roadless rule was created, I think, because some people thought it was a really quick way to do wilderness. But so they called it the roadless rule. Well, there are almost no roadless rural area polygons in the state of Utah that didn't have roads in them before. So when we're talking about, you know, how expensive it is to build roads and all this, no, what we're asking for is just administrative use of some of the roads that were in there before. So with the way that it works right now with the roadless rule is, even if there's a road there inside the roadless rule, inside the roadless area, we can't use it to go in and fight fires. We can't use it to go in and do logging operations or habitat improvements or, you know, clean up the forest. So what we're asking for is just to be able to use those roads that are currently there to go in and do the active management needed for healthy forests for all the reasons that I articulated before.
Well, that was one of the questions I was going to ask you is, does the federal government even have the money to build new roads? I mean, that's one of the arguments, that the government right now isn't even able to maintain some of the roads they have. But what seems like you're saying is, we're not talking about building new roads necessarily, just give people access to the ones that are there, at least in part.
Yeah. You know, a lot of times the timber companies, they'll be the ones that go in and improve the roads. Sometimes we'll be working with other state agencies that are going to be willing to pay some money to go in and improve those roads so that they can get equipment in. But then once the road has been used for, you know, maybe it's a year, maybe it's 2 or 3 years, then that road will be, when we say decommission, I'm just going to say not used anymore, because decommission sometimes means that you take it back to its natural state, which we probably wouldn't do because we may need to go in there in another 20 or 30 years and do another treatment in that area. But almost all of these areas are not just going to be gates wide open. Everybody, you know, take your mechanized vehicles and just start going across the country. If there are any roads that we, you know, want to open up, say, you know, on top of the Boulder Mountain, there used to be some roads that went out to viewpoints where you could look over the entire Escalante Grand Staircase area. If we wanted to open up one of those roads, we have to go through the forest management plan. We have to go through the project NEPA. There's probably 3 or 4 NEPA steps, all involving public comment, before you would open a road for that kind of use. So, what we're talking about, what we're focused on here at the state, is really just being able to use the roads that currently exist inside these roadless areas to do wildlife habitat, fuels reduction, those kind of works.
Final question. What happens if this rule goes away? What happens? Do things change right away? Will you see some sort of, will the effect of it, I suppose, come not immediately, but later?
So if the rule goes away, then we still have to go through all the public NEPA processes in order to do projects on the ground. So if we wanted to open up an area for timber, then we still have to go through a timber sale process. We have to go through the NEPA for that. If we needed to do road construction as part of that, depending on what the forest plan says, we might need to do a different process for that. So the short answer is, if the rule goes away, you're not going to see vast changes across the landscape as far as, you know, people going out there on 4x4s and 4-wheelers. That's not the process. It will be slowly getting back to doing active management to get back to healthy forests and healthy landscapes. And if we do have some roads that are really important for tourism and outdoor recreation and mountain bikers and people that enjoy scenery, things like that, that will take a long process to get those roads opened up to be used that way again.
Rich Johnson, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for your time.
Reg Johnson. He's the director of the Utah Public Lands Policy Coordinating Office. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners like you. Become a member at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been discussing the roadless rule. It's a policy that protects undeveloped U.S. forest land. It's been in place for nearly 25 years, but now the Trump administration wants to get rid of it. Let's go back to Chris Wood. These days, he's the president of Trout Unlimited, but back in the late 90s, he worked for the Forest Service. And he says at that time, the agency had found itself in a hole, and that the roadless rule came about in response to this idea known as the rule of holes.
The rule of holes is simply that once the hole that you're digging is over your head, you should simply put down the shovel. And we applied that to the roads question in the National Forest System. This is an agency that had 270,000 miles of road. And they had about an $8.5 billion, with a B, dollar maintenance backlog on that road system. And when Mike Dombeck, the chief of the Forest Service, starting in 1997, and I started at the agency, that first year, or maybe it was the second year, Congress came within a single vote of cutting 80% of the Forest Service's roads budget as a surrogate to get the agency to stop building roads in roadless areas. And you might say, well, that's a logical response, right? I mean, the power of the purse and all that. The problem was that the roads budget included maintenance and reconstruction funding for these roads that were falling off hillsides in the national forest system. And, you know, gravity works cheap and it never takes a day off. So when those roads fall, they typically find a creek or a stream below them. And that increases sedimentation and erosion. And not only that, but they're unsafe to drive on. So the rule of holes was simply, look, let's take a conservative look at this. If the agency then had an $8.5 billion backlog, and today it's got about a $10 billion backlog on all of its maintenance, not just for roads, but for other infrastructure, well, maybe we ought to take a different approach. And let's pause. And that's how the roadless rule started. It actually started with a pause. What we did is we did an 18-month moratorium on the construction of all new roads anywhere in the national forest system so we could get a better handle on how we're going to take care of this backlog. And in the context of doing that 18-month moratorium, we realized that's a big issue. We need to take care of that. It's simply common sense. But there's a bigger issue out there, and that's that people – most of the American people value public lands for their sense of naturalness and wildness and the clean water they provide, the hunting and fishing angling opportunities. And these so-called roadless areas of the national forest system were some of the most important commodities that the Forest Service owned or managed, but their highest value was simply leaving them intact for people. And that was basically the genesis of the roadless rule. It started as an economic argument about our inability to maintain the existing road system. And that thread, you know, remained current through the whole conversation. But then it evolved somewhat into, well, it's a social and ecological issue as well, because these roadless areas are, you know, they represent 2% of the landmass in the United States, but they provide habitat for 25% of the endangered species in the United States. They provide drinking water for 60 million Americans. These are disproportionately important.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that the roadless rule in some way created this unintended consequence. It began as this kind of economic decision to deal with this backlog of billions of dollars. And it transformed into this effort that benefited this larger, deeper sense of preservation about wilderness and land. It became something much – it began as an economic thing, and it became something deeper, it sounds like.
You know, part of the roadless rule, I think, was a lesson in how the government can actually be responsive to people, right? We were public servants. They still are public servants. They serve the public. And the public made very clear that their interest, what they were most interested in, was keeping those places intact through that earlier roads policy that I described. Yeah. And that's why we made the pivot. And it had the happy benefit, I think, of reestablishing the Forest Service as a conservation leader. And for the past quarter century, the Forest Service, I believe, has been the envy of most natural resource management agencies, I would say, in the world.
Hmm. How much of this issue, this debate, this decision, and we'll get to larger motives in a minute, but how much of the decision to rescind the roadless rule is about timber?
It's not about timber, period. The Forest Service took all the valuable timber between 1960 and 1990 from the National Forest System. If it could be accessed and sold at market, they got it. They got it. So it's not about timber. This is typically low-value stuff that the agency decided not to go after because it was too expensive or too remote or not valuable enough. And so it's a bit of a canard to say that it's about timber. I don't hear people in the industry demanding access to roadless areas. They don't want that. I mean, the timber industry, they also need social license to operate in their communities. And they don't want that controversy. There's not a timber operator I know who would say, yeah, I really want to go after that low-value timber. It's going to cost the government more than I'm going to sell it. They're going to sell it to me for. And I'm going to spend about 7 or 8 years to get that single timber sale done.
So if it doesn't make any sort of economic sense, if it's not about timber, what is it about? Because you said something interesting. You said because of what you described as this religion of deregulation, that there's this kind of almost spiritual religious fervor about what, stripping rules out of the federal system? Is that what you mean?
I do. I think this is a little bit more of a religious argument than it is a common sense argument or an economic argument even. And what I worry about now is that this proposal that doesn't make economic sense because there are not high-value timber products in most of these areas, that it's an argument that doesn't need to happen and it will set the Forest Service back. Now, what I'm about to say may discourage people from wanting to get involved, and I hope it doesn't because, you know, again, the Forest Service is they're a public agency. They work for us. And while we may not elect them, we do elect the people that oversee them. And I don't think there's a lot of forest supervisors out there in the national forest system who, unless they're directed by their political, you know, appointees to punch a bunch of roads into roadless areas, who are going to be eager to say, yeah, let's get after it. You know, let's go into those roadless areas in Utah, the 4 million that exist there, and let's go build a bunch of roads so we can access some low-value timber, which we will sell at a loss. Let's go. That's going to be great.
So what you're saying is this is not coming from the agency. It's a political directive, is what you're saying.
Oh, without question. There is no appetite, none, within the Forest Service to reopen this debate.
Of course, people who are advocating, outside of the administration even, we talked to someone who people who want to get rid of the roadless rule say that one of the problems with it was that it kept the Forest Service from actively managing the forest. Tom Schultz, the chief of the Forest Service, said that this is how he put it. He said, leaving things alone doesn't mean that things will be managed. So that's one thing. And then that gets us to the fire question. Because when you stop actively managing the forest, this is how the argument goes, that it limits these natural forest ecosystems that are dependent on fire to be healthy. So how do you respond to that argument?
Well, look, I think Chief Schultz is a good guy and he knows a ton about forestry. There's no question about that. But Just take Utah, for example. So there's about anywhere from, I can't remember if it's 8 to 10 million acres of national forest system lands in the state of Utah. Mm-hmm. And about 4 million are in roadless areas. About 40% of all what they call hazardous fuels treatments, thinning, burning, all the things they do to either try to reestablish fire back into these fire-adapted ecosystems or to reduce the number of trees per acre because there are too many now because we've suppressed fires so well for so long in fire-adapted ecosystems. About 40% of all the hazardous fuel treatments in the state of Utah have occurred in roadless areas. Think about that. So the idea that we're not able to go in and manage these areas, it's just the data belies that statement.
What about the argument that you need to build roads in roadless areas to fight fires?
80% of all the fires that occur in the national forest are human caused, and about 80% are started within a mile of a road. And so the idea that building a bunch of roads in roadless areas is going to help us fight fires, again, is belied by the data.
So it sounds like, Chris, that you think we've come to a kind of public consensus about this roadless rule. And that's one of the reasons it's been so durable, the fact that it's remained intact over the course of 6 presidential administrations, Democrats and Republicans. But let me ask you if you think that consensus can survive the moment we're in now, because we're pretty divided politically. And I wonder if you worry if this is going to become another one of those litmus tests for people who are loyal to the Trump administration. And so whether there will be people who would be willing to speak out in a moment like this, what do you think is going to happen in that sense? Like, how does this roadless rule and the debate that's playing out now, how does that fit in this moment that we're in?
Such a good question. You know, I'm an angler. I'm an inveterate optimist. My old boss used to say, you know, if I keep digging, there must be a pony in this pile somewhere. And I think it will work out. I think common sense will prevail. I do. And I think if enough people make their voices heard, the job of elected leaders, it should be to serve people. But many elected leaders see their jobs as getting reelected. And if enough people make their voices heard, I think elected leaders will recognize, well, this isn't in my self-interest to support this rescission. It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make economic sense. It doesn't make ecological sense. It's not socially something people want. And so I have hope here. And I may be Pollyanna here, but I think if enough of us raise logical arguments and help the administration realize that there are different ways to accomplish their objectives without rescinding, you know, a tremendously durable rule that has withstood 3 Democratic administrations and 3 Republican administrations, then I think we can protect these areas. I mean, I honestly believe that, without overstating it, that roadless areas represent the best of America. They're a reminder of who we were, of where we were when we settled the frontier, independent of their extraordinary ecological benefits, and especially if you're a hunter or an angler. Just we should keep those places intact. And, you know, I've said this before, and I don't mean to sound glib, but if it turns out that there's some rare earth mineral that can only be harvested from roadless, only mined from roadless areas, and we need it to stop the onslaught of the coming Martian invasion, we'll go get it later if we need to. But the root of conservative and the root of conservation are the same. It's the Latin word conservare. And that means to hold or keep in a safe state. And that's what the roadless rule does. It is, by definition, the most conservative regulation in the history of the United States. All it does is it keeps and holds these areas in a safe state. So anyway, that's my hope. Again, it may be Pollyannish, but, you know, there's got to be a pony in this pile somewhere.
Chris Wood, thank you very much.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
Chris Wood, he's the president and CEO of the conservation organization Trout Unlimited. The first public comment period on the repeal of the roadless rule closed a few weeks ago. The Agriculture Department should have a draft environmental proposal ready by March. Then there will be another round of public comments. A final decision, though, on all of this isn't expected until later next year. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. We're on Instagram at Radio West, or you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.